it goes.
Ticked off, tee off. This is it.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin! Happy Friday. We have made it to another weekend. And once again, I couldn't be happier about it.
We all like Fridays.
We all like Fridays. It's funny to get to that age where the Friday used to be the night to go out, and now I just cannot wait to sit at home and do nothing.
I know, and go to bed.
And just go to bed.
Yeah.
And still go to bed at a reasonable hour. I don't know when that shift happened, but it's certainly probably since starting this job.
Changed.
So that is the voice of returning champion, friend of the show, Democratic campaign veteran and strategist, Joe Zepecki is back for the full hour. It's been a minute, man. How are you doing?
I just assumed that much like Donald Trump at Fox, there was some kind of soft ban or a shadow ban, if you will. I'm just happy to be here. Thanks for having me back,
we're
guys.
So
I don't
happy.
Know how I don't know how I got back in the good graces, but whatever I did, it was worth it.
Well, I know you're also a busy guy. You know, you have appearances here and there. You know, sometimes you're in D.C. doing big, important things, given your input, given your hot takes. But every once in a while, we need you back on the show because we have so much to catch up on. I feel like there's a lot that's happened.
It's been a while, yeah.
That I'm excited to get your thoughts on. And so since you were last here, we have coined the first segment of the first hour, the ticked off tee off.
Oh.
So what are you ticked off these days? Is there anything that's really riling you up, Joe Zepecki?
There's a couple things.
Okay.
I don't know if an hour or the first segment is long enough.
Okay.
I am ticked off about Troupis.
Okay.
Who has been reappointed to a position of public trust. Troupis, of course, being the Republican attorney who was at the center of the fake electors plot. You're trying to tell me there's no other qualified attorneys in the state of Wisconsin who could serve in that role? Give me a break. So that's ticking me off.
Let's start there because someone forwarded me like the official document saying that he'd been reappointed. And I got to be honest, I didn't know what this committee, the committee sounded important, but I didn't know what it was. And I didn't even know that he was sitting on it. I knew him as the guy who, like pretty on the Republican side, a well-respected judge, lawyer, legal expert, but who was also pretty disgraced coming out of the fact that he was the advisor to the fake electors in 2020, including basically working with Ron Johnson so Johnson could try to get these two Pence.
Well, he was the advisor when they weren't talking to Dan Kelly, but that's a whole other
question. I'm going to make that point, too. I was like, oh, so this guy's on this judicial committee, but then the other guy's up for the Supreme Court. Like, what are we doing here? And so what does this committee do, and why is it important?
Well, this is not the highest profile. This is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel here. Attorney Jim Troupis was reappointed to the state's Judicial Conduct Advisory Committee by the state Supreme Court. So the advisory committee, there are standards of ethics within the legal profession. So actions, claims can be brought against attorneys. You know, we sometimes hear words like, you're going to be disbarred for that. Judges, if they engage in misconduct in office, can be sanctioned or cited. And so my understanding of it is rather than any old schmo off the street can say, Attorney Bry, I don't like you. You're disbarred. That there's an advisory committee that sort of weighs these challenges or these proceedings around discipline for judges, just as there is for attorneys. And in fact, Troupis was at the center of a allegation against, I believe it was Justice Karofsky, that was basically laughed out of court. Because he was mad that they didn't take the challenge to the fake electors and the results of the 2020 election and probably didn't like something that Justice Karofsky had written in the court's opinion saying, get the heck out of here. This was a free, fair, safe, and secure election. And so he tried to get her in trouble. What business does that guy have if he's bringing, false claims or bad actor actions against sitting members of the high court. It's ridiculous. And so, is this the most important thing? No. But it goes to show that the conservative movement and conservative elements of even the highest court in Wisconsin are still deeply in thrall of former President Donald J. Trump. And that's a problem. And it's bad politics for them. I just don't get it.
And because this is not the political advisor's like background. This is four people sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court that are supposed to be nonpartisan. So like even if they respect this guy's legal mind, it's also just like it's a bad look.
Yes, exactly.
And yet so they don't care.
Right. So much of reality is perception. And, we'd be here for a year if we talked about all of the ways in which perception becomes reality, but it's just a bad look. You've got this real fight going on in the Republican Party and the conservative movement that shows itself not just in primary fights between Dan Kelly and Rebecca and Judge Doro, or between Tim Michaels and Rebecca Clayfish, but also on stuff like this. Half of the party is saying, let's move on from Donald Trump. The other half is still deeply in the clutches of Trumpism and the MAGA movement, which hasn't worked out for them. But if they want to ride that train till the wheels fall off, to mix the metaphors, be my guest.
Well, and that's an interesting point as far as Jim Troupas is not running for Wisconsin Supreme Court. He was just reappointed by the current conservative Wisconsin Supreme Court, and his peer, let's call him Dan Kelly, who, as you said, also had some coordination advice. They called him at some point. Andrew Hitt is on record in his deposition that he also consulted with Dan Kelly on the fake elector situation. We don't know what was said. Attorney-client privilege, all of that.
But here's what we know, if I could just stop there. Okay. Like, Kelly has answered this question, but not to my satisfaction. Yeah. If someone calls you up and says, hey, you're my lawyer, I need legal advice. I'm thinking about overthrowing an election. I'm thinking about submitting false electors to the Congress of the United States. The legal advice is, that's a terrible idea. Don't bring me into this. Don't have anything to do with that. And then you hang up the phone. And so if that's what Kelly had done, I think he probably would have said that, because from a political standpoint, that's the A answer. And the fact he can't say that means that's not what he said.
Well, and that was going to be my next thing is, like, in this divided electorate Republican base or Republican voters, isn't this even a bet for the women who are sitting on the Wisconsin Supreme Court right now who want Dan Kelly to win? Is there no strategy behind them thinking that maybe we shouldn't reappoint this guy for the people who would normally vote for the conservative/Republican-backed candidate, because it's showing that we're just further and further have not moved on from the election denial situation?
That is certainly what it looks like to me. I don't get it.
They just don't care.
Yeah. Ticked off over Troupas. What are you ticked off about?
What am I ticked off about? I'm ticked off. I don't want to move on because I do want to spend some time getting your thoughts on where the status of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But what am I ticked off about? What were we ticked off about this week?
Boy, there has been a myriad of things.
There's been a myriad of things. I'm really ticked off. I mean, this is not a Wisconsin thing, but had Tony Evers not been reelected, it could have been a Wisconsin thing. I'm really ticked off about Tennessee. And the drag shows and the the anti-trans gender confirming care and that sweep of bills. I mean, the one thing that I think I said this last night in my 60-second roundup of news, that I felt like one piece of good news in Wisconsin yesterday was that a federal court dismissed the case in Eau Claire that Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty had brought on behalf of some anonymous parents for protecting our children or something, because the Eau Claire School District had put in policies that basically was inclusive. Yes. To protect kids. And they needed it. The burden was on this parents protecting our children group to say how this harmed them. And big surprise, they could not prove how this harmed them or their children. And so that felt encouraging here, but that doesn't mean across the country that infuriating things that are violent are not still happening and that I'm ticked off about.
Yeah, it's infuriating and just deeply sad that the party that wants you to believe that they're about small government wants to intrude into every part of your life, right? The doctor's office, the bedroom, relationships between children and their parents and their peers. It just sort of exposes the disconnect between that long held philosophy and the fact that the Republican Party has moved beyond that, because they're no longer a party of policies and principles. They're a party of outrage and a cult of personality when it comes to Donald Trump. And that's just not sustainable. It's not healthy. It's not good for democracy. And in this case, it's endangering kids. And that is both infuriating and sad all at the same time.
And now they're picking on librarians. Librarians.
Oh, those nasty librarians. They had it coming.
The most evil, maniacal group of people in our country, those crazy librarians.
Wait, which story are you referencing right now?
I'm just talking about the strictures that they're trying to put on public libraries and what they can have in their own libraries if it's LGBTQ inclusive or anything like that. It's ridiculous. It's like the way, I don't know, a former administration in Wisconsin demonized teachers.
Their go-to move is othering people and dividing, divide and conquer. That appears to be the through line so often. And it's challenging. But then again, that's, I think, why progressives have been doing so well in Wisconsin. We can't let off the gas. I know after the break we'll talk about this next election, but I was reminded this week, I was having a longer conversation with some journalists from outside of Wisconsin. 13 of the last 16 statewide elections in Wisconsin have been won by the Democrat or the candidate supported by progressives, and those 16 elections were all after Donald Trump won Wisconsin in 2016. 13 out of 16 is pretty good.
Pretty good record.
Especially when you consider it's like a 50-50 jump ball state, and a lot of those races were so close. But the tie has increasingly gone to the progressives and liberals and Democrats, and that's a good thing.
Absolutely. All right, well, when we come back, we're going to talk more about the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where we're at. We're a little more than a month away, so let's talk about it. Stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Paperman meets such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And our guest for the full hour is friend of the show, Democratic campaign strategist, Joseph Pecky. And we are just kicking around all the things that it's been accumulating because it's been a while since he's been here. And so before we get to your thoughts on the status of the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, Jane, you said we got some texts?
We do have some texts. You know, we were talking about Jim Tropas being reappointed to this judicial advisory board. So texter from the 414 says, could it be these people of dubious scruples are being put in positions of power because the GOP believes they won't win the Supreme Court and will put their people in place before they lose their appointment powers?
Ooh,
I like that.
Interesting.
Smart theory.
That is a smart theory.
And then we were also talking, I just made a comment about how I find it amazing that the GOP is now targeting librarians because they're such underminers of the social fabric of our world. And the 262 says there was a big attack on librarians at a school board meeting in the Kettle Moraine School District this week.
I think there's something going on in Waukesha, too.
Yeah.
I haven't had the time to, like, I had someone email me, and I wanted to look into it more before we started talking about it on air, but, the thing is, it's so clearly there's national organized groups behind this that it's happening not just across our state, but across the country.
Yes.
And it all looks like the same playbook again and again and again. And it's not just, telepathic groupthink that's happening, that everyone feels this way. Like, clearly there's an infiltration, whether it's through social media and Facebook groups and things, as far as like the messaging that is being beaten into certain groups' heads of what they have to do to like take back their school board.
Well, it's a strategy, right? That, you know, if strategically you want to get to an end result of not allowing anyone to access materials that we would say are more inclusive, then you start to look at, well, how do we get there? Librarians, I would guess, are still pretty high up on the trust factor. Mm-hmm. Like, if you ask people who are in their community, doctors, teachers, police officers, firemen, librarians probably are pretty well trusted. And so it makes sense from a strategic standpoint that if they want to influence what's on the shelves of library books, they have to sort of smear librarians and undermine their credibility in order to get the outcome that they want. It's a disgusting strategy, and it's, you know, these librarians don't deserve it, but that's what they're doing. You're right. It's not by accident. It is a playbook. It is a strategy. And that's why we got to fight back against this stuff.
And it's not grassroots. This is not, this is not springing up in local communities where people are coming with torches and pitchforks to their local libraries. This is, as you said, Joe, this is a national strategy. This is all intentional.
All right. Well, we got a Wisconsin Supreme Court race that, as of this week, is the most expensive race in U.S. history.
Wisconsin.
Congratulations.
We did it.
Whether this is a good thing or a bad thing is yet to be seen, but it is a thing. And so both boots on the ground, well, both sides are going to, well, go ahead.
Well, can I take a victory lap first? I think people finally understand what, like, last year, November, December, as we were talking about this race on this program and on others, I was telling people, like, voters are going to be hiding under their couch cushions again soon, because the amount of money spent on this race was always going to be astronomical. There's so much at stake. And so, you know, I'm not right that often. So when I am, I want to take my little victory lap.
Well done, Joe.
Good job, Joe. Good job. You were right. Although I have to say, and this is maybe because I don't watch a ton of basic cable, it's not yet felt like, oh my, I cannot escape this. Has it felt like that for you already?
It's getting pretty bad.
Yeah.
For example, I walked by, you know, a dozen TVs this morning in the Third Street Market Hall at the Grand Avenue. Yeah. And, you know, so they got lots of sports centers on and morning talk shows are on. I'm telling you, those ads are there. Now there's way more of them for Janet and against Kelly. But those ads are—they're running.
I'm definitely getting texts.
Yeah.
I'm definitely getting texts.
Yeah, me too.
And well, one of the things. So, where do you feel like the status is right now, as far as arguments being made, resources? Like, what is kind of your takeaway? A little bit more than a month away from the election.
Yeah. So it's advantage Protasiewicz in some really important ways. Let's start with the money. The money is overwhelmingly for her. And that's good. You have to, in all elections, communicate your message to voters. She has the resources to do that. She is doing that. And that's good, because she can make the case about the type of justice that she will be, what her values are, and the type of, you know, Supreme Court justice she'll be. And also to make the case against her opponent. Dan Kelly has a track record. He has been on the court for 4 years. He was appointed by Scott Walker. And so this is a choice. There's only two candidates to vote for. And Protasiewicz has the resources to make both arguments very compellingly. Kelly does not. And on the message and on the politics, he's in a box. Like, when you listen to interviews he's doing, he is not criticizing what Judge Protasiewicz is saying about one of the most important issues, which is access to reproductive health care for women. He's criticizing that she's saying it. And just think about what a bank shot that is. You know, Judge Protasiewicz has come out and said what her values are, that she believes that Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban, which is on the books in the wake of the Dobbs decision, is disgusting and ridiculous, both of which are true. These are not controversial statements. And rather than Kelly being able to say, well, she's wrong and here's why, he has to try to criticize the fact that she's saying that at all. And that's just a really hard message to get across to voters and make them understand, particularly when you're being outspent to the degree that he is. So it is an uphill climb for Kelly right now, and progressives cannot let off the gas. We've got to finish strong. I'm old enough to remember Brian Hagedorn winning an election we thought we were going to win by less than 6,000 votes.
Yep. All right, when we come back, I want to get your thoughts on where we're at with the budget. Joseph Pecky is our guest. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And our guest this hour is Mr. Joseph Pecky. Always love having you here. He's very smart.
He is smart.
He has things to say.
He does.
He has opinions. At least he sounds good.
if you don't know what you're talking about, Dan, you fake it really well.
A face and voice for radio. Yeah. That's the second time she's called me Dan Schaefer.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice to be in good company. Yeah, us white guys with beards. We all kind of look the same. That's fine.
Leftish, bearded.
Just don't call me late. Just don't call me late for dinner, Jane.
Not a problem. I'll make sure you're on time.
All right. Well, as always, you can give us your thoughts, 844-967-2789. That's 844-96-PARTY. But moving on to new topics that don't feel so new, but they are ongoing, that of the budget negotiation. And
we're just getting started.
We are just getting started. And it's always interesting for this show, whenever there is an article about some update, whether it's another piece of, like this week, the 3.2 or is it 3.8 billion for building projects?
$3.8 billion capital budget.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, so things that are still kind of details from Governor Evers' proposal that get highlighted individually, then responses from Republicans that are on the Joint Finance Committee and kind of what giving the press a little bit of an idea of what they're thinking. And it's like, what do we actually, like, what's worth talking about until there's something more substantial? But we have to fill 3 hours a day, so we're going to talk about it.
and it's all worth talking about. These are the decisions that are going to impact the state's competitiveness and, you know, where we go for the next couple of years, right? The old Joe Biden saying is, don't tell me your values. Show me your budget and I'll tell you your values. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to care about as a state for the next 2 years? What's going to change from the last 2 years? These are important questions.
Did it surprise you how big it is?
The budget?
Well, Governor Evers, Governor Evers' proposal with all the different things he wants to fund at the level he wants to fund them.
No, because Evers is viewing this responsibly and understands the opportunity available when you have a $7 billion surplus, right? So, you know, if we're to take a step back, Republicans have really abdicated some responsibility when it comes to paying for things that have to be paid for in the last 12, 13 years that they've been in control of the legislature. So, for example, the University of Wisconsin system alone has $5 billion with a B in deferred maintenance costs that have piled up because Republicans don't want to pay for things. And that's a problem. How do we know it's a problem? There are buildings on the UW-Madison campus where stuff is just falling down. This is a building that should have a lifespan that expands another dozen years out to 2035. And because of, you know, maintenance backlogs and not paying for the things that have to be, you know, kept up, we have parts of them falling down. Thank God a student wasn't walking, you know, at that moment. Somebody could have been killed. Mm-hmm. And so you have all these backlogged costs, things that have been put off. What better time to make good on expenses that have to be incurred than when you have a $7 billion surplus? And so what the governor is doing is he's not saying, we're going to do all $5 billion just to the UW system. There's more priorities. There's other decisions that can be made. So he's proposing, for example, using some of the surplus to buy back debt, which will ultimately save Wisconsin taxpayers in the Wisconsin budget more money in the long run. That's really smart. In fact, that's fiscally conservative. He's also saying, we have some one-time money. Let's address some of this backlog. Let's update some of these buildings that need to happen if we want to continue to thrive as a state. And he's not spending the whole surplus on that. There's other things that he wants to do, like try to, you know, do some one-time and probably also some ongoing revenue streams for units of government, local municipalities. We have mayors and county officials from across the political spectrum in communities that are urban, suburban, rural, exurban, you name it. They are all crying out and saying, we are being starved of resources. We cannot even meet the cost to continue, much less make investments in the things that have to happen to keep our communities safe, to keep our communities going. Things like law enforcement, transportation, mental health services, the sort of the nuts and bolts of local governance and what people think of when they think about their village or their town or their city, what they're supposed to be able to do. And among, you know, and with a $7 billion surplus, you can do some of that in shared revenue. And you can surge funding one time for programs like literacy, because we know the numbers are in that kids fell behind on reading during the pandemic. So in a perfect world, would we have to spend more money? No, but you know what? We don't live in a perfect world. Mm-hmm. We live in the world that we have. And these are priorities. These are things that matter. You know, the governor has declared it the year of mental health, it's much like with reading. The numbers are in. We know that the mental health crisis is acute and growing, and we do not have the available supply of mental health professionals and services to get people the support that they need. And if we can't, there is a toll that that will take, and there's a cost to that. And so I think the governor's budget is very responsible. It saves money where it can. And when it can, it chips away at some of this backlog that Republicans have allowed to fill up. The one last thing I would say on the budget is we've also seen the governor once again say, let's expand Medicaid. Let's finally accept the 90% of Medicaid funding that the federal government will pay for. It's been a dozen years. It would save another $1 billion in state money. And Republicans in the legislature have said no for a dozen years. Yesterday in North Carolina, Republicans finally said, okay, we're going to do it. We're ready to come to the table and accept Medicaid. So hope springs eternal. Perhaps, you know, Mr. Voss, Mr. LeMahieu, their caucuses will understand, hey, we got $7 billion to work with here. Want to make it $8 billion to work with? Let's expand Medicaid after, you know, the dozen years of saying no. So that's something we would like to see. It's common sense. It is supported by the people of Wisconsin. And that's the difference, is the governor's proposal is responsible. It invests where we need to, and it tries to take advantage of a unique opportunity while also returning some money to taxpayers. Right? Like $7 billion is really hard to like get your head around, mm-hmm. but you can do all of those things I already talked about and give a tax cut for working in middle-class families. And rather than come to the table and say, hey, some of this is really great. Some of this we want to fiddle with. Some of it we're not going to do at all. Instead, you've got Robin Voss calling the governor names and suggesting that he lives on another planet. And it's like, give me a break. Like if the governor said he wanted to spend $3 American of state money in the next 2 years, they'd be like, no, that's too much. The governor's totally out of touch. Not a penny more than $2. And it's like, come on. That approach is how you end up with $5 billion in deferred maintenance backlogs and buildings that are falling down and putting at risk students on college campuses, which is not what anybody wants. So we got to get serious about this.
Yeah, but Joe, if the Wisconsin Republican Party actually starts doing things on behalf of all of their constituents, that's going to blow up their entire business model. I mean, they know best what we need. They know best when it comes to women's health care. They know best when it comes to how to spend money. They know better than the rest of us, and they're going to do what they believe is best. And they also think that $7 billion belongs to them.
Yeah, it's not great. It's not great.
Well, and I think that's the thing that sometimes is because we have short memories, right? And I think we had C.J. Safer in here yesterday, who's a conservative. He's the president of Institute for Reforming Government. And so it was interesting the way that he was talking about reforms and certain stuff with reading, like we were talking about that. And he tried to sneak in, like, what schools spent their COVID, like, their COVID relief money on. And then they weren't even spending it on learning loss or mental health. And I was like, yeah, because they haven't been funded and their funding hasn't kept up with inflation. So a lot of the way I understand it is a lot of these school districts had to dip into that for their general budget just to keep the lights on. And then in general, for schools to not know what their budget's going to look like every 2 years is not very stable. And so the backlog, again, just like the maintenance for buildings on the UW campus, the backlog for a lot of school districts and the inconsistency of school districts and the unpredictability of what we're going to be able to spend is not creating great environments. And some of that, you can say that they're spending a lot now, but that's also because we haven't been spending enough for how long?
Yeah. Yeah. These are choices. And the choices that Republicans have made with the budget for the, you know, going back probably five or six budgets now, 10, 12 years, they've made their choices. And those choices are catching up with us. The bill comes due. It always comes due.
Do you think, this is totally speculative, do you think there's any of them that are kind of realizing that this could be their last hurrah if Protasiewicz gets elected? Or do you think they don't think like that? No,
I don't think they think like that. And here's the thing. None of us should be under any illusions that if Janet Protasiewicz wins in April, that all of a sudden Democrats are in control of the legislature.
That's true.
That's not the way this is going to go. If she wins, which we hope that she does, fill out your early ballots. Early voting starts soon. You can request an absentee ballot. Don't sit this one out. But even if she wins, it's going to take some time for the maps to come back before the court. And even if they are drawn more fairly, more fair maps aren't going to start with Republicans at 50 and 22, but they're not going to start with Democrats at 50 and 22 either. You're going to have to go out and win elections and talk about your values. And the best outcome would be, you know, 20 in the assembly and maybe, you know, 8 to 10 in the Senate, where there's an actual competitive balance. And sometimes Republicans win and sometimes Democrats win. And until we get to that, a lot of this, right? So, like, I'm just not sure that Republicans are looking over their shoulder going, oh, no.
I don't mean as far as control over the legislature. I also mean if this, in this, knock on wood, we get fairer maps before 2032. Because what I always think about is it how it changes who can win. So even if it's going to end up being a Republican or a Democrat, but the type of more moderate candidate, because the districts are drawn in a way where it's because of like communities of interest versus everyone who votes Republican, because that to me is so much of what the problem becomes, whether it's in federally in Congress and what we've seen of how many fringe people are representing different districts, and also in our state legislature, that it's like I'm very close friends with some very left representatives and state senators, but it's also because they're only going to lose their seat if someone primaries them. And the same is true on the other side. And so it's more of potential that it changes who runs and who can win, even within their own party.
Yeah. And we can't stop at fairer maps. We have to look at things like ranked choice voting, open primaries. And I don't know how to express my displeasure with you, because you just cited the year 2032, which is the year I turned 50, and you made it like, I am broken inside. You have shattered my world. That I turned 40 last year, and I had not once thought about turning 50 until you just did that to me, Kristen. How dare you?
Well, at least you don't have American Girl dolls that are historical that were born in 1990 and being like, oh, I owned my first American Girl doll before this doll was supposedly born.
Oh, you crazy kids. You crazy youngsters.
We love you, Jade.
Yeah, get back to me in a decade, okay?
All right. Well, we are going to take another break, but Joe Zepecki is still going to be here when we come back. We're going to lighten it up a little bit, talk about what he's reading, talk about what we're watching. and Pop Culture Friday Hour. Not hour, segment, whatever. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I'm Kristen Bry. She's Jane Nevet-Nair. And Joe Zepecki, Democratic campaign strategist, has been here all hour, making our job a little bit easier.
Thanks so much for joining us, Joe. Seriously, so it's always good to see you.
I feel like we just got to do like a monthly. Can you commit to a once a month? I know other shows get you like once a week, but we'll get you on here once a month.
The Up North with Pat Kreitlow. You can listen to me Thursday mornings.
See?
Pretty early, though. It's pretty early.
It is pretty early. I'm up by the time Pat's show starts, but I'm usually starting to prep for this show. But I tune in every once in a while and see what he's talking about. But yeah, the 6 to 8 hour, that's, I mean, Jane did that for a long time.
Decades
as far as the, because what time?
And it was five.
She was like,
it was at five. I started.
And you didn't
have
to, and you didn't get to do it from home. So take that, Pat Kreitlow. Quickly, before we get on to lighter topics, I know we're going to talk about this actually with Representative Mark Pocan, who's going to be here next week. But we've talked about this before as far as Medicare Advantage and its disingenuous name as far as what it is. And I know you have some thoughts on this.
Yeah, I just think it's really important for people to know that health insurance companies who provide Medicare Advantage, which is a supplemental program to Medicare, the health insurance companies are about to get their profits nicked just a little bit by the Biden administration, because the Biden administration has proven over and over again they want to lower healthcare costs for the American people, and they think Big Pharma is doing just fine. And so in advance of a new rule from CMS around the reimbursement rates for supplemental insurance packages, the health insurance industry and Big Pharma are out there lying and suggesting that Joe Biden and Democrats want to cut Medicare Advantage. Nothing could be further from the truth. They are trying to make the program more efficient, work better for customers. If you need something on top of Medicare, that's fine. Go and do that. But the health insurance companies are flat out lying when they say that Joe Biden and Democrats are going to cut Medicare. Don't believe it. Talk to the people on Medicare in your life. Make sure that they know it. Mark Pocan, I know, will do a great job explaining this challenge and legislation that he's introducing to tackle this. The president's budget will be out next week, and people will see that, no, Joe Biden is not trying to hurt Medicare. He is trying to strengthen it, and them's the facts, folks.
And you know, Joe, those ads have started already. I saw a couple of them. Yeah, I saw a couple of them this week, and the scary, and they're going to take it all away from you. So like you said, talk to the people in your family and your life who are on Medicare and set them straight.
Exactly. Amen to that.
Because the bill that Pocan is authored is basically that they have to change the name. Is that?
Well, and that some of it has to do with marketing practices, right? That like Medicare is a government-run program for seniors over the age of 65. You know, parents and grandparents are on it. And that's often in our, you know, in the zeitgeist and in our politics. Medicare Advantage is, again, it's a supplemental insurance that seniors can pay out of pocket for. And that's a little, it gets a little confusing for folks as to what that actually is.
Absolutely. All right. Well, what are you reading these days, Joe Zepecki? Fun stuff. I know.
So I read two books within, in the month of February. Actually, well, I read more than that, but, first of all, I read across that bridge, John Lewis, the late John Lewis, the late great congressman of Selma fame. We all know, we all miss John Lewis.
Good trouble.
Reflections on his life. Got that at the African American History and Culture Museum in late January and was able to read that. Really remarkable. And two other books that I read that are just fascinating and I'm recommending to everybody. The first is A Brief History of Motion by Tom Standage. And it basically is about the way that the automobile created the world as we know it.
Oh.
It is fascinating. It's the history of from like the 1890s through, you know, what's next? How will self-driving and autonomous cars impact our world? How are the smartphones we carry in our pockets similar to the automobile in the way that they are literally reshaping societies and the ways that we live? You know, we never stop to think about the fact that the advent of the automobile changed the way that couples coupled and mm-hmm. courtship took place in this country. And it's a really interesting, like, sociological, historical, technological innovation mashup that really makes you think about the world.
Do they talk a lot about the cities that were developed pre-car versus post-car? Because yep. I did a history of economics class in college, and I remember them, and I was a community college, so I was still in Los Angeles. And one of the things that always stuck with me is the fact that Los Angeles technically was already starting to develop, and they had a really good like train system, trolley system. And then when the cars came, they just got rid of all of it. And now it changed the hellscape of traffic that it is today, right. That you need to have a car to be able to live there. And I think about that in so much of like Midwest and further past the Mississippi, like into the West Coast, it's just cities that like are car dominated. Like they're dominated by cars versus on the East Coast, you still can kind of get from state to state via train. New York is obviously, even though they need to update their subway system, because it's talk about something that's been not funded well, but it still gets you where you need to go, and you do not need a car in that city. And so, yes, I wish we had more public transportation. But what was the third one?
The even nerdier one, the aftermath. The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America by Philip Bump of the Washington Post. Fascinating statistical analysis of from the silent generation through Generation Z, the ways in which baby boomers broke the world. And you know, for example, the baby boomers like broke the education system in this country because there were so many of them that you had to invest and build new schools. Now baby boomers are breaking things like the healthcare system and long-term care. And some of the solutions to those challenges are the same solutions to when they broke the education system. There are communities and states that are rehabbing old schools and turning them into long-term care facilities. So just a really fascinating look at like where we've been, where we're going, what it means for our politics and culture. And it's not just charts and facts and figures. There's little vignettes. They go down to the villages in Florida that we meet the first baby boomer, you know, the ones that Life magazine decided was the very first baby boomer. It's fascinating. But I don't just read all the time. I also got a shout out. March is breaking my brain when it comes to peak TV. We got to finish The Last of Us. Mandalorian is back. Ted Lasso's coming back. Top Chef is coming back. Succession is coming back. There's so much culture. How can anyone keep up with it?
That's true. I don't really care about Top Chef, but everything else, sign me up for. All right, I know. Oh, my God. Did I just totally ruin your day?
No, you ruined our friendship, Kristen.
All right, Josepecki, thank you so much for joining us today. This was really fun. Have a great weekend. I will talk to you soon, my friend.
All right, sounds good.
All right, when we come back, John Russell is going to give us an update on East Palestine. We haven't talked to him in a couple weeks, but he has been on the ground reporting from Ohio, so we will hear from him when we get back. This is As Goes Wisconsin.